Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Julian Barnes, who reads from and discusses his highly acclaimed new novel, Arthur and George, published by Knopf. In the weeks to come, we have Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Well, thank you for coming this evening. At last, Julian Barnes is here at the Tattered Cover. Whining pays off, I think. It has been many years since his appearance for Talking It Over, and so we are delighted to greet him again and celebrate the U.S. publication of his new book, Arthur and George. Mr. Barnes is the author of 10 novels, 2 books of short stories, and many essays. In 1984, he wrote Flaubert's Parrot, about an English doctor's obsession with Gustave Flaubert. And now again, he turns to a literary figure to frame his novel, this time Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous creator of Sherlock Holmes. George of the title is George Edalji, is it? Edgley. Edalji. Thank you. The son of an Indian father and a Scottish mother, who is wrongly accused of mutilating cattle in a case rampant with racial prejudice. This story is based on the actual meeting of these two men when Arthur Conan Doyle becomes a champion of George Edalji, and like the protagonist of his famous books, he becomes a detective eager to ferret out the truth and overturn this blatant miscarriage of justice. But this is just the bones upon which a wonderful story is hung. P.D. James wrote in her review, "This book combines the satisfactions of biography, social history, and the excitement of a real-life detective story, all in the hands of a major novelist." Please join me in welcoming Julian Barnes.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be back. I don't know why my publishers insisted on punishing me for so many years by not sending me here. I'm going to read for about 15 or so minutes and then take questions if you have any. I'm going to read a section. The narrative is divided for a long way between the Arthur story and the George story, and they join at a certain point. I'm going to read from the Arthur section, the beginning of a key episode in Arthur's life. By 1893, when he was 34, Sherlock Holmes had made Arthur Conan Doyle rich, world famous, and exasperated. He felt that Holmes's fame was overshadowing the rest of his work, and that his historical novels, which he thought were the best of him, were being disregarded. So he decided to kill off Sherlock Holmes in this year. And little did he know when he did this that it was going to be a general year of death and crisis for him. His father died untended in a Scottish lunatic asylum. He was committed for alcoholism, though quite how mad he was, I'm not too clear, because he said one thing that seemed to me manifestly sane. He said, "I've only been locked up here because the Scotch don't understand my jokes." Sherlock Holmes was killed off, and Conan Doyle's first wife, Louisa, known as Tui, received a death sentence. So a real death, a fictional death, and a death foretold. When I say she received a death sentence, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And in those days, given the state of her general state of health and her state of her lungs, she was given 3 months to live. Doyle, who is a doctor himself, accepted the diagnosis but refused the prognosis. And by dint of fierce determination, money, and the best doctors, trips to Davos and to a hotel called the Mena House Hotel in the shadow of the pyramids, which people tell me is still there, where while his wife lay on the veranda taking the air, he played golf on a golf course that is apparently still there. He kept her alive not for 3 months, not for six, not for 12, but for 13 years, which was an amazing achievement. But perhaps inevitably, after 4 years, he met another woman. I should explain that the downside, one of the extra downsides to diagnosis with tuberculosis, was that the couple were told to refrain from marital relations because of her health. So he was in a peculiarly painful and poignant position of his wife was condemned to death at some point in the future. He was condemned to chastity because he was an honorable man. And so the longer he kept his wife alive, the longer he was extending his own period of sexual frustration. And then after 4 years, this happened. I'll read the start of it. And then he meets Jean. Arthur is the first to admit that his knowledge of women is that of a gentleman rather than a cad. There were certain boisterous flirtations in his early life. There is his wife, Tui, who, over the years, became a companionable sister to him, and then, suddenly, an invalid sister. There are, of course, his real sisters. There are the statistics of prostitution, which he reads at his club. There are stories told over port, which he sometimes declines to hear. Stories involving, for instance, private rooms in discreet restaurants. There are the gynecological cases he has seen, the confinements he has attended, and the cases of disease among Portsmouth sailors and other men of low morals. His understanding of the sexual act is diverse, though related more to its unfortunate consequences than to its joyful preliminaries and processes. His mother is the only woman to whose governance he is prepared to submit. With other members of the sex, he has been variously large brother, substitute father, dominant husband, prescribing doctor, generous writer of blank checks, and Father Christmas. He is solidly content with the separation and distinction of the sexes as developed by society in its wisdom through the centuries. He is resolutely against the notion of votes for women. When a man comes home from work, he doesn't want a politician sitting opposite him at the fireside. Knowing women less, he is able to idealize them more. This is as he thinks it should be. Jean, therefore, comes as a shock to him. It is now a long time since he looked at a young woman as young men habitually do. Women, young women, it seems to him, are meant to be unformed. They are malleable, pliant, waiting to be shaped by the impress of the man they marry. They hide themselves, they watch and wait, they indulge in decorous social display, which should always fall short of coquetry, until such time as the man makes apparent his interest, and then his greater interest, and then his especial interest, by which time they are walking alone together, and the families have met. And finally he asks for her hand, and sometimes, perhaps, in a last act of concealment, she makes him wait upon her answer. This is how it has all evolved, and social evolution has its laws and its necessities, just as biological evolution does. It would not be thus if there were not a very good reason for its being thus. When he is introduced to Jean at an afternoon tea party in the house of a prominent London Scotsman, the sort of event he normally avoids, he notices at once that she is a striking young woman. He knows from long experience what to expect. The striking young woman will ask him when he is going to write another Sherlock Holmes story, And did Holmes really die at the Reichenbach Falls? And perhaps it would be better if the consulting detective had got married. And how did he think up such an idea in the first place? And sometimes he answers with the weariness of a man wearing 5 overcoats. And sometimes he manages a faint smile and replies, "Your question, young lady, reminds me why I had the good sense to drop him over the falls in the first place." But Jean does none of this. She doesn't give an agreeable start at his name or shyly confess herself a devoted reader. She asks him if he has seen the exhibition of photographs of Dr. Nansen's voyage to the far north. "Not yet. Although I was present at the Albert Hall last month when he lectured to the Royal Geographical Society and received a medal from the Prince of Wales." "So was I," she replies. This is unexpected. He tells her how, after reading Nansen's account a few years previously of crossing Norway on skis, he acquired a pair of them, and how from Davos he skied the high slopes with the Branger brothers. And then he begins a story, which he often tells as an adjunct to this one, about losing his skis at the top of a snow face and being obliged to come down without them, and how the strain on the seat of his tweed knickerbockers. And this really is one of his best stories, though perhaps in the present circumstances he will amend the conclusion about being happiest for the rest of the day when standing with his trouser seat against a wall. But she seems to have stopped paying attention. Taken aback, he pauses. "I should like to learn to ski," she says. This is also unexpected. "I have excellent balance. I have ridden since I was 3. Arthur is somewhat piqued at not being allowed to finish his story about tearing his knickerbockers, which includes mimicry of his tailor's assurances about the durability of Harris tweed. So he tells her firmly that it is most unlikely that women, by which he means society women as opposed to female Swiss peasants, will ever learn to ski, given the physical strength required and the dangers attendant on the activity. "Oh, I am quite strong," she replies, "and I imagine I have better balance than you, given your size. It must be an advantage to have a lower centre of gravity, and being much less heavy, I should not do so much damage were I to fall." Had she said "less heavy," he might have taken offence at such pertness. Because she says "much less heavy," he bursts out laughing and promises one day to teach her to ski. "I shall hold you to it," she replies. It was all a rather extraordinary encounter, he reflects to himself in the subsequent days. The way she declined to acknowledge his fame as a writer, set the subject of the conversation, interrupted one of his most popular stories, exhibited an ambition some might call unladylike, and laughed, well, as good as laughed, at his size. And yet she managed to do it all lightly, seriously, enchantingly. Arthur congratulates himself on not having taken offence, even if none was intended. He feels something he has not felt for years, the self-satisfaction of the successful flirt. And then he forgets her. 6 weeks later, he walks into a musical afternoon, and she is singing one of Beethoven's Scottish songs while an earnest little fellow in white tie accompanies her. Arthur finds her voice superb, the pianist mannered and vain. He draws back so that she will not see him observing her. After the recital, they meet in the presence of others, and she behaves with a sort of politeness which makes it difficult to judge whether she remembers him or not. They separate. A few minutes later, with some ghastly cellist groaning away in the background, they meet again, this time alone. She says at once, "I see I shall have to wait at least 9 months." "For what?" "For my skiing lesson. There's no possibility of snow now." He doesn't find this forward or flirtatious, though he knows he should. "Are you planning it for Hyde Park?" he asks. "Or St. James's, or perhaps the slopes of Hampstead Heath?" "Why not? Wherever you wish. Scotland? Or Norway? Or Switzerland?" They seem to have passed, without his noticing, through some French windows, across a terrace, and are now standing under that very sun which has long banished all hope of snow. He has never resented a fine day more. He looks down into her hazel green eyes. Are you flirting with me, young lady? She looks straight back at him. I am talking to you about skiing. But those, it seems, are only her nominal words. Because if you are, be careful I do not fall in love with you. He barely knows what he has said. He half means it entirely, and half cannot imagine what has got into him. Oh, you are already in love with me, and I with you. There is no doubt about it, no doubt at all. And so it is said, and no more words are needed or uttered for a while. All that matters is how he is to see her again, and where, and when. And it must be arranged before someone interrupts them. But he has never been a Lothario or seducer, and never known how to say those things which are necessary to arrive at the stage beyond the one where he currently stands, not really knowing either what that further stage might be, since where he is at the moment appears, in its own way, to be final. All he can feel rising up in his head are difficulties, prohibitions, reasons why they will never meet again, except perhaps decades later in passing, when they are old and grey, and will be able to joke about that ever-remembered moment on someone's sunny lawn. It is impossible for them to meet in a public place, because of her reputation and his fame. Impossible for them to meet in a private place, because of her reputation and all the things that make up his life. He stands there, a man approaching 40, a man secure in his life and famous in the world, and he has become a schoolboy again. He feels as if he has learnt the most beautiful love speech in Shakespeare, and now that he needs to recite it, his mouth is dry and his memory empty. He also feels as if he has ripped the seat of his tweed knickerbockers and must instantly find a wall against which to set his back. Yet almost without his being aware of her questions and his answers, it is somehow arranged. And it is not an assignation or the start of an intrigue. It is merely the next time they will see one another. And in the 5 days he is obliged to wait. He cannot work, and he can barely think. And even if he plays 2 rounds of golf in 1 day, he finds, in the seconds between addressing the ball and bringing the club face down against it, that her face has come into his head, and his game that day is all hooks and slices and the endangering of wildlife. When he propels the ball from one sandhole directly into another, he suddenly recalls golfing at the Manor House Hotel, and feeling then that he was in a perpetual bunker. Now he cannot tell whether this is still true, indeed truer than ever, with the sand even deeper and his ball buried invisibly, or whether he is somehow on the green forever. It is not an assignation, though he finds himself getting out of a cab at the corner of the street. It is not an assignation, though there is a woman of indeterminate age and class who opens the door and disappears. It is not an assignation, though they are at last alone sitting on a sofa covered in satin brocatel. It is not an assignation, because he tells himself it is not. Thank you very much. I should say I meant to say before I read it, actually, that scene has absolutely no historical basis. that's to say, we know exactly the day on which Arthur Conan Doyle and Jean Leckie met one another, because thereafter he celebrated it by always giving her a gift of snowdrops on that very day. But we have absolutely no evidence of where they met, who introduced them, what happened, or anything. He lied about it in his autobiography. The early biographers were very discreet. Their letters to one another in this period have not survived. So actually, that was very good news for me as a novelist, because it means you have just a little bit to work with and you can take off from there. Happy to take questions on this or any other book or most matters, really, within reason. Yes, sir? It changes from past tense to present tense at different points and for different reasons. And I want the reader to be almost unaware that this is happening. But I think of it as a change in focus. And in the present, at that moment where he says, and then he meets Jean, Arthur, who is the famous established historical figure of the two men, has always been in the past tense up to that point, because he is, you know, he's there in the real in the past, existing. Then we get to the episode in his life of which there's absolutely no evidence, and also the moment when he falls in love. And as either he or one of the other characters says, love is in the present tense, so he shifts into the present tense at that moment. So I use it for different reasons, different points, according to the state of the characters. And I don't want to say any more about it, because I don't want to make readers too conscious of it. There's only there's one moment in the final episode of the book where it shifts. It's meant to be visible as a tense change, because it's in the middle of an episode and someone walks into a great hall in blazing lights for the very final episode of the book, and at that point it moves from the past tense into the present. So it's about emphasis, focus. Yes, absolutely, yes. And it's Adelji, because all Parsi names are stressed on the first syllable. He was the son of a very interesting man, who Shapoorji Adelji, who was born a Parsi in Bombay and was converted by Scottish missionaries, came to England, trained as a vicar, was ordained into the Church of England, and then married a Scottish woman, and was then given a living in Staffordshire, in the wilds of Staffordshire, in a sort of mixture of mining and farming community. And there the couple had these three children of mixed race, George, Maud and Horace, who, as their names imply, were brought up to be entirely English. How more English can you get than George, Maud and Horace? And yet, you know, as George discovers all too sadly, just because you're called George doesn't mean that people think you're English. But yes, he was it's a forgotten episode in British social and even legal history, because the case eventually led to the setting up of the Court of Criminal Appeal in Britain, which hadn't that and one or two other cases. But even lawyers have forgotten it. I've said to them, do you know anything about the Adelji case? And they've said, oh yeah, was that sort of sale of goods or something? I say, no. It's always been a story in Conan Doyle biographies, but it's never, for 100 years, no one has touched it. So when I found it, I thought, that's for me. That's mine now. I don't write in French. I've never written in French, ever. Flaubert is one of my great literary heroes, yes, absolutely, and I've written a book about him. But I don't think I write like him in any way. I mean, I think he's sort of iconic figure to many writers, not just me. I mean, I can think of three other writers as various as Milan Kundera, Philip Roth, Mario Vargas Llosa, all of whom revere Flaubert as much as I do. Indeed, Vargas Llosa has written a wonderful book about him called The Perpetual Orgy, which isn't a hot book as it might sound, but a quote from Flaubert, who said, we must plunge ourselves into language as into a perpetual orgy. He's the writer's writer par excellence. He's the saint and martyr of literature. You read his letters and you learn what the highest ideals of a writer are and could be. But that doesn't mean that you should try and write like Flaubert, because the problems that he faced and the state the novel was in then are quite different from the state the novel is in now, and plus which I don't write in French. So in a way, it's the best sort of literary hero to have, someone who can't possibly influence you except in your general attitude to your profession and the seriousness with which you take it. I'm not going to answer the second question, but I'll tell you how I got the idea for this one. I was reading a book about the Dreyfus case, and by an English historian of France called Douglas Johnson, who said it's curious to reflect that there's a case rather similar to the Dreyfus case that took place in England a few years after it. That's to say, there was a shocking crime, a miscarriage of justice, a sentence of hard labour, a racial element to the case, Dreyfus being Jewish and Adelgee being half Parsi, key element of an expert witness in handwriting who misled the court, and finally a great writer, a famous writer anyway, riding to the rescue, Emile Zola in the Dreyfus case, Arthur Conan Doyle in this. And he said, but the Dreyfus case continues to echo down the centuries and the Adelgee case has been forgotten. And he went. He was very witty. He died only last year. He was a very witty historian. And he said, you might think that the difference between the two cases is that the Dreyfus case was about high treason and the Adelgee case is about animal mutilation. But the British are probably more shocked by animal mutilation than they are by high treason. Which I thought was a sort of... you are a witty fellow. And then afterwards I reflected and thought he is actually a wise fellow as well, because I don't know if the name Anthony Blunt means anything to you, but Anthony Blunt was one of our most famous traitors in the 20th century. He is one of a circle of key spies who came out of Cambridge. Philby, Maclean, and Burgess were the names of the other three. And Anthony Blunt was the sort of shadowy fourth man who was unmasked some years after the other three. And the thing about Anthony Blunt was that he was an extremely distinguished art historian as well as being a Soviet spy for 30 years. And he was a great expert on Poussin. He taught Anita Bruckner, for instance, who revered him. He was in charge of an art institute called the Courtauld Institute in London, and more to the point, he was the keeper of the Queen's pictures, and he looked after the Queen's pictures at Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle. When he was unmasked as a traitor to the Soviet Union, in the pay of the Soviet Union, they said, "Well, that's very naughty of you, but carry on keeping the Queen's pictures, because you're jolly good at it, you know, and just make sure they're cleaned on a regular basis and that sort of thing." And I thought when I was reflecting on this, that this man, this historian I read was so correct, because if Anthony Blunt had been caught taking a knife to one of the Queen's corgi dogs, for instance, he would have been out on his ear, you know. But treason? Ah, sure, get on, look after the pictures, don't worry, not very important. Do I ever think about what my life would be like if I was writing in the Victorian period? Well, not really. I'm jolly glad I'm not, in many ways. I mean, because there are lots of things you wouldn't be able to write about in quite the same way. I don't know. I mean, you have mixed feelings. There's sometimes when you envy writers of earlier ages because you think, they had all that material, which was new. And there seems perhaps at times less new material now because they've gone over it, you know. But I think it's less... I think it'd be less... It's less worrying than if you were, say, a playwright, a British playwright anyway, because you'd start off with Shakespeare hovering over you all the time and think... maybe it's a lack of imagination, but I sort of think I've got enough problems on my plate without wanting to have been born 150 years ago. The stunt was to send, and it's a stunt that's been pulled in America as well. Some years ago, there was a writer, Jerzy Kaczynski, is that right? And someone sent his first book or his second book in again 20 years on to the publisher who published it, and they turned it down. And I think it's a stunt that is double-edged, you know. I mean, Doris Lessing did it a bit ago. She wrote a book under a pseudonym and sent it in to her publishers, who turned it down. She was fantastically cross, and never crossed her mind they might have been right, you know. And this is always the trouble. I certainly wouldn't do it with any of my books. I can't remember who did. It was a journalistic prank or something, and they sent one or two the opening chapters of one or two quite well-known books into various publishers, and most of them were turned down. I mean, sometimes, you know, you get to, it may not come to an editor who's actually read the book in question, and they may think, well, this is a bit talented, but it's a bit old-fashioned, you know, like feels as if it's 20 or 30 years old. I don't know. As for prizes, I think one should regard them always as a species of posh bingo. And if your number comes up, it does, and if not, it doesn't. That's what I think. But then I'm much more interested in having just bought a $1 ticket for, what's it called? The Powerball, yes. And I'm quite sure that I'm going to win $218 million tomorrow. I'm just a question of whether I take the annuity line or take the cash. So this may be the last time I do a book tour. Yes? Thank you for bringing that point up. I did think that the only advantage of leaving for a 3.5-week American book tour 2 days after my 60th birthday was that I would forget all about it. What? No, I left home on the 21st of January, which was 36 hours after my birthday. What a present, I thought. I don't think this is different because of my age. I just think my books are different from one another, and I'm one of those writers who is more willing to amend the style to suit the book and to be at the service of the book than to write in a style which says, "Hello, I'm here." So, thank you for answering that question. One last question, yes? The facts of the case are as I laid them out and as I discovered them. Though there was, for example, no transcript of the trial. There were only rough accounts in provincial newspapers. Arthur Conan Doyle's life and character are very well documented. Except for this great emotional black hole, which is the point I started reading at. George Adelgee is nothing really more than a predicament. You know, he's a chap in a hole. And there's almost no... There's a brief character description of him by Doyle. So he had to be invented from the ground up. And Doyle, it was more a question of sort of cutting away at bits of Doyle. What do I need of this well-documented life? Because your needs as a fiction writer are quite different from the duties of a biographer. So, you know, Doyle went to South Africa for the South African War, the Boer War. And I'd think, do I need to send him to South Africa? He went, but is there any purpose in my book in sending him there, or should I just mention it? You know, you have the liberty of mentioning it in a word, mentioning it in a line, or making it into an episode. So even when you're loyal to the facts as known, there's a lot of leeway and malleability with them. Funny, when he meets Jean, and the circumstances I told you about of his wife and his condemnation to chastity and there's been a lot of debate among Doylians about, and some sceptical Doylians think he might have had an affair with her, because this went on for 13 years before his wife died. Well, 9 years of knowing Jean. And my reading of his character was that he was a deeply honourable man who would have done his very best to be loyal and to protect his wife, while at the same time knowing that this was a serious love. And I had an email contact with an American biographer of Doyle called Daniel Stasher, who wrote a very good biography a few years ago. And at one point I said to him, my reading is that Doyle was a deeply honourable man, and they didn't have an affair. What's your reading of it? And several days went by, and I could sort of almost hear him thinking in Washington, where he lives. And it finally came back, and he said, "Yes, I absolutely agree with you. On the other hand, I think there might have been a Clinton moment." So I didn't. I stopped just before the Clinton moment in that scene to whet your appetite. But that again, I thought that gives me a certain license to let the imagination go. Thank you very much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 7th, 2006.